Namaste everyone. Welcome to the Charvak podcast. This is Kushal Behra. So today's podcast is this ongoing tussle that is going on between Israel and Iran. So from what I understand, and I'll let Abhijit explain it in detail, there was an airstrike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, from what I understand. And it was said that Israel is responsible for that airstrike. And then in retaliation, Iran basically launched dozens of drones. I don't know the exact number as of now, but dozens of drones were launched towards the Israeli airspace, which were, I think, I remember the press conference, they said it was they were dealt with 99% accuracy or something of that sort. That's what the press conference said. And now we are where we are. And anyways, Abhijit had gone to Israel. He's just come back last week. So I wanted to talk to him about the trip to Israel and what are the state of affairs over there in general. And then Israel was like, nahi ruko, humko Iran se bhi jhagda hone wala hai abhi. So here we are. So abhi mere ko bata, so what is the state of affairs? So where is the baseline for us? Like, I'm so confused. Like, what is the baseline of this conflict?
So very upset the Iranians attacked one day after I left Tel Aviv. You know, we spent our entire trip waiting for whatever to happen there because it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to report from a place like that, you know. But anyway, it was what it was. Because, you know, the access you get all of a sudden becomes much higher in terms of getting... A lot of people spoke to us, but we're not allowed to quote and things like that. And then they start coming... online, so as in you can quote them and things like that. So what happened is it's a mistake to look at this as Israel bombing the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Israel never admitted responsibility for that bombing. Okay, the same way the Iranian Revolutionary Guard attacked an Israeli diplomatic compound in Buenos Aires in 1996 or 7, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Israel didn't respond formally to that. They did what they had to do quietly. So Iran broke a major rule here because Israel never admitted responsibility for the bombing that took out two IRGC, two Iranian generals in the Damascus embassy. Iran should have probably stuck to proxy actors. Okay, the same attack that got carried out, they could have given to Hezbollah, they could have given to the Houthis and things like that. I don't know why they decided to attack directly. They did anyway. So what's ended up happening here is they broke a major rule of the game, which is that unadmitted attacks should be responded to by unadmitted attacks. We've done the same thing, by the way. If you remember Pulwama, the attack in Pulwama was carried out by unknown actors, according to them. But we know exactly who carried it out. It was Pakistani intel. And it was a state response. The Balakot airstrike was a state response to non-state actors. Okay. So that shifted the paradigm. There's also been the case last time of just a few months back, of the Iranians attacking Pakistani on Pakistani soil in response to a Pakistani terror attack in Balochistan. And the Pakistanis hit back and the Iranians shut up. They consider it issue closed. So here, they're basically preventing, they're saying, oh, we're going to do lots of things if you hit us back for a state-on-state strike. Remember, Balakot was responded to by the Pakistanis by their F-16s and JF-17s. They had tried to attack an Indian base. They definitely shot down an Indian fighter aircraft the following day. So there's very few, and Pakistan hit Iran back. So, you know, this new thing that somehow Israel attacking Iran back is going to escalate is complete rubbish. They've decided to escalate. I suspect what they want. So, you know, this is a lot of desires that are being projected. In many ways, I guess Israel was hoping Iran would hit them because then it gives them an opportunity to go after Iran's nuclear facilities. Yeah. They never admitted it publicly, so it was kind of lalkaring, teasing them in that sense. But the second thing that happened was that why does Iran openly admit that it's going to attack? They want an Israeli attack of some sort, and they're warning of consequences. Why? Because they want a direct Israeli attack to justify going nuclear. Right? They have been attacked by a nuclear state, therefore we retain the right to go nuclear. And they're hyping up the consequences of that attack because they basically want the Americans to tamper down any Israeli strike on them. Take so they want to have their everybody here wants to have their cake and eat it as well, which you can't do. Because the enemy never thinks the way you do. Israel didn't act the way Iran wanted it to. Iran didn't act the way Israel wanted it to, etc., etc., etc. Classic case of escalation dynamics. It could escalate, it could not escalate. I mean, it really depends on what some countries have already decided in their minds, and the action is kind of going to be irrelevant in that sense.
Now, the natural questions that come over here is why would Iran choose to respond in a situation like this when they know Israel already has an ongoing conflict in Gaza? They already had the proxy way of dealing with Israel, or did they think that their strategy of using Gaza as a war front has not worked out perfectly because Israel, they did not expect Israel to respond the way they are responding this time, which, depending on which side of the political or social aisle you are, globally or ideological is the right word. I would not say political. You would find it right or wrong or a bit of both. So why would Iran choose to launch these drones? Could this be that this is like a sideshow or some sort of a camouflage or a distraction which keeps Israel busy and actually something else is being planned? Is that one of the possibilities?
Yes and no. See, it's impossible to really say. But one of the reasons that Iran wanted to do this. Now, first, let's see why those two generals sitting in Damascus got killed. Because they were coordinating Hezbollah activity. Okay? They were clearly coordinating Hezbollah activity from Damascus, which is why Israel felt the need to take them out. I mean, we're all pretty clear that Israel did take them out, whether they admit to it or not. Just like they took out the Syrian nuclear reactor, which they finally admitted to. They still haven't officially admitted to it. It's kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge admission in that sense.
This is
But
like Rajnath
Iran,
ji talking about Pakistan on ANN.
yes, exactly like that. Now, why would Iran want to do this? Because Hezbollah hasn't been getting much success in terms of, see, this is now a competition for brownie points in killing Jews. Hamas inflicted a Jew killing, which is unprecedented in history since the Holocaust. So Hezbollah has to catch up. The problem is, if Hezbollah actually does catch up, Lebanon pays such a heavy price, there's a huge chance that the Lebanese population turn on Hezbollah. They did in
Why?
2006.
If you don't mind
They
me
did it.
asking, why? Why would they?
Because it's a powder keg of a society. Remember, Lebanon went through a very long, very horrible civil war. It used to be a Christian majority. It was created as an artificial Christian majority, like Pakistan was created out of India, or Kuwait was created as an oil majority out of Iraq. This place was created as an artificial Christian majority out of Syria. And what has happened is Christians are no longer in a majority, and we now believe that the Shia are in an absolute majority. It was believed in the 80s that the Sunnis were in a majority. We now know the Shias are almost certainly in an absolute majority. But it's a very screwed up society be precisely because of these religious dynamics. There's been no census in Lebanon since 1920. Okay, so for 103 years, Lebanon has functioned without 104 years, Lebanon has functioned without a census. And why is this important? Because by law, the president has to be Christian. The prime minister has to be a Sunni. The speaker of parliament has to be a Shia. Okay. Now, again, what ends up happening is before, When Lebanon was created, the president had all the executive power. But after the Lebanese Civil War, the executive power was given to the prime minister instead. So the prime minister was the powerful one. But the Shias are now in an absolute majority and they're not getting their share. Okay. Now, what happens? So a lot of what Hezbollah does is actually internal politicking in order to change the situation in Lebanon itself. There are, in fact, two Shia parties out there, Amal and Hezbollah. Okay. Amal is, they do terror strikes every now and then, but they're not apparently that big. I mean, they do like naam ke waste terror strikes here and there. People don't, Israelis at least haven't died so far from an Amal strike. But Hezbollah is basically maintaining a kind of Shia control over Lebanon without legal control over Lebanon in that sense. Right? So it's a very important Shia, how should we put this, counterweight to a political system that disfavors them. And remember, this can turn at any time. Because, you know, Christians and Sunnis can say, boss, we're not picking up the tab for your adventures. In which case, Hezbollah gets bogged down in a civil war all over again. Remember, the first civil war in Lebanon was largely triggered by the Sunni influx of Palestinians moving in there. And lots of tension coming out because of it. Because once the Palestinians moved into Lebanon, Lebanon became a Sunni majority country. Right? Which is why to this day, Palestinians don't have many rights. Palestinians are no longer refugees in Lebanon. They've lived there for the last 70, 80 years. Right? And they're still counted as refugees. They're not allowed to take up jobs and all kinds of stuff like that. So it's a powder keg of a society, which is very a bit exploited very intelligently by Iran in that sense. So these chaps were basically doing hera-feri out there. And the generals were coordinating all of that. They were technically almost the Iranian viceroys to Lebanon and Syria in that sense. Because remember, Syria could not have won the similar, the Syrian government couldn't have won the civil war had not been for Russian air power and Russian involvement and Iranian ground power. It was Iran and Russia that won the Syrian civil war for the Assad family. So that's the equation out there.
Okay, fine. Now, I want to talk about the Indian response. So, can I read for the benefit of everyone? Because this goes in audio also. So, our minister, Dr. S. Jaishankar, has tweeted this. I spoke with to the Iranian FM Amir Rabdol, I don't know, whatever, man. AMI.
Abdul Hamidian.
इतने लंबे लंबे नाम होते हैं ईरानियों के. स्पोक टू द ईरानियन एफएम दिस इवनिंग, टुक अप द रिलीज ऑफ 17 इंडियन क्रू मेंबर्स ऑफ एमएससी एरीज, डिस्कस द करंट सिचुएशन इन द रीजन, स्ट्रेस द इम्पोर्टेंस ऑफ अवॉइडिंग एस्केलेशन, एक्सरसाइजिंग रिस्ट्रेंट एंड रिटर्निंग टू डिप्लोमेसी, एग्रीड टू रिमेन इन टच. दिस इज द ट्वीट ऑन ईरान. ठीक है. नाउ just concluded a conversation, this is also today or yesterday, sorry, just concluded a conversation with the Israel finance minister, shared our concern at the developments yesterday.
Foreign Minister.
Yeah, so, oh, sorry, foreign minister, I apologize. Discuss the larger regional situation, agreed to stay in touch. This is a very differing response from our minister in both cases, because from what I mean, I'm giving you a layman's understanding, not an expert understanding. But in case number one, we seem to be having a much more detailed discussion with the Iran side, where we stress on the importance of avoiding escalation, exercising restraint, returning to diplomacy, while with the Israelis, discuss the larger regional situation. I mean, I don't know what to make of it. What do you make of it? Because I was
Okay,
genuinely confused.
so the problem in diplomacy is what is not discussed actually says a lot more. Okay, or rather, what is not put out in public. Remember, Iran has taken 17 Indians hostages, 17 Indian sailors hostage. They essentially did an act of state piracy, captured a ship day before yesterday. And took 17 out of the 22 crew, 17 were Indians, and they've been taken a hostage, and they're being kept in a Iranian holding facility right now, jail, basically. Of course, why they would be captured, no idea. Just because it had Israeli marked cargo doesn't mean you can take them. So notice Jaishankar didn't protest that either. He's managed to secure the fact that an Indian diplomat can go visit them and they will have continued consular access, which in a country like Iran is a big thing. The second thing is our sympathies here lie with Israel. Okay. But our actions, we did essentially what Iran did. Remember when Pulwama happened, we launched a state-on-state strike, which is what Iran has done. तो हम किस मुंह से ईरान को बोलेंगे कि ये नहीं करना चाहिए? आई मीन वी कान से डू व्हाट आई से नॉट डू व्हाट आई डू. सो दिस इज द सेकंड कंपल्शन ऑन जयशंकर. एंड बेसिकली व्हाट ही वुड हैव चैटेड अबाउट वाज इट वुड हैव बीन अ यू नो डिप्लोमेटिक कॉन्वर्सेशंस, इवन वेरी हार्श वंस आर वेरी पोलाइट. ओके. सो व्हाट एंड्स अप हैपनिंग इज ही वुड हैव सेड, बॉस हैव यू थॉट आउट व्हाट यू आर डूइंग? Do you know what the Israelis are planning? What is your plan of de-escalation? He would have basically gotten a deep briefing down from the Iranians on what they intend to do in various scenarios. That is what that is the way of decoding Iran. So three things: in-depth discussion on all the possible routes, de-escalation routes that Iran has, to the Indian sailors who are currently in Iranian captivity. And third is the inability to tell Iran to behave itself because, well, we did Balakot in response to Pulwama. With the Israeli, it's very clear that there was no condemnation. That's very important. See, they didn't condemn at all. The onus of escalation has been placed on Iran. It has not been placed on Israel. Because in the meeting with Abdul Hamidian, he had said escalation. In the meeting with Israel, there is no talk of escalation. Because India fundamentally believes that there is a right, that Israel has a right to respond when somebody respond does nonsense like this. Okay. So that is how I would read through this entire document. Well, the two tweets at least.
Okay, now tell me. I'll get to your Israel trip in the second half, but I want to talk about this also. Now, where do the Americans come in all of this? So how do we look at the American role? Because inside America, there are two very weird balancing acts that are happening in America right now. I'm not talking about the Republican Party. I'm talking about the Democratic Party because they are the ones in power right now. And it doesn't matter if obviously beyond a point, it doesn't matter what the Republicans say. What do you make of the response from the Democratic Party as of now? I remember you even tweeted something Blinken ke bare mein. You had co-tweeted something where Blinken was talking about if
Now,
I remember.
So see what the problem right now is, the Americans are petrified of this escalating. But also they're stuck between two vote banks. Remember, the Democrat vote bank, the biggest folks and liberals in America are New York Jews. And they're the biggest fundraisers of the Democratic Party. Okay. On the other hand, the biggest vote bank, guaranteed vote bank, are American Muslims. Okay. There is a lot of overlap between the Democrats and the Muslim Brotherhood. People like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib are out and open, supported by the Muslim Brotherhood and Muslim Brotherhood affiliated organizations in America. Okay. So they are stuck in a hard spot where they have to balance these two. So on one hand, if Israel decides to go berserk, they can't hold back on aid at all. They'll have to be committed to Israel, just like they were during the attack, which they went and stopped it in that sense, right? Well, they helped stop it at least. But what ends up happening is, even if you end up stopping it, you also have to prevent them from doing this to the Iranians. Okay. But if they do it to the Iranians, you're duty bound to help them. You can't do anything about it. There is another very important reason that America, you know, people think that it's the Jewish lobby. It's only because of the Jewish lobby. No, it isn't. The amount of intel that Israel provides to America is insane. And intel is more addictive than cocaine, heroin, and all of that. Why? Because, you know, the ability to know who is plotting against you, who is trying to harm you, who's trying to do what, actually saves lives. You get so addicted to it because Israel has fantastic intelligence networks, not only in the Middle East, they also have fantastic intelligence networks in Russia, in Turkey, in China, right? And all of these are provided to America on a golden platter. So it's very, very important for that Israel relationship. People think that it's a one-way dependency. It's very curiously a two-way dependency. Can America do without Israel? Sure. Will the price of that breaking of that friendship be painful? Yes, extremely painful. Okay. Israel can't do without So this is the equation that the Israelis also have to calibrate. Number one. Number two is, you know, Biden wants that nuclear deal with Iran again. The Israelis do not want the nuclear deal. They want to precipitate an attack in which Iran goes nuclear. So then America goes all out and destroys Iranian nuclear facilities. America and Democrats specifically, because the nuclear deal was, what's his name? Obama's legacy. Biden wants the nuclear deal back on the table. But all the peninsula Muslim countries, Oman, the Emirates, the Saudis, the Bahrainis, the Qataris, even the Qataris, and the Kuwaitis want the Israelis to be demolishing Iranian nuclear facilities because it adds a huge complexity to the region, which they don't really want. So this is something which is a very difficult path to negotiate your way out of. Because Iran wants something to happen so that they can then say we're going to go nuclear now officially. Iran's complaint was that the nuclear deal did not make Iran non-nuclear in perpetuity. Because the Americans are like, boss, what treaty is perpetual? There is no such thing as a perpetual treaty till the end of time that Iran won't go nuclear. We can only look at here and now. We can't do this with all the additional bells and whistles that you want. If we thwart it by 40, 50 years, that's fantastic. Great. Bibi always wanted to be, Netanyahu always wanted to bomb the Iranian facilities. So this is where there is another point of conflict and differences between Israel and America emerging, where you'll actually find very curiously, the Arab countries would almost all in private be on the Israeli side. Remember, the Jordanians played a very important role in shooting down a lot of the missiles that headed Israel's way. They've, you know, put ties on hold. They keep abusing the Israelis over what's happening in Gaza. But when it came to actually protecting Israel, they protected Israel, which the Saudis will do. Tomorrow, if the Israelis want a flight path over Saudi Arabia to hit Iran,
They
the
will.
Saudis will happily do it. They'll just say, can you please provision for one or two of your fighters to get shot down by us so that we can claim we shot you down? Okay. This kind of cooperative shooting down has happened in the past also. You know, surprisingly,
So फनी तू मेरी मार मैं तेरी मारता हूँ फिक्स मैच सब मैच फिक्सिंग होते हैं
So, you know, in the Yom Kippur War, what happened was in 73, what happened was the Jordanian king sent a message to the Americans saying, can you please ask Israel if Golda Meir would really mind if I sent some 200-300 tanks to shell some border towns here and there? And Golda Meir was like, see, under normal circumstances, we'd be fine with you know, coming a few kilometers in. But right now, you know, I'm under too much pressure in both Syria and on the Syrian border and the Egyptian border. So please don't send it. Wo banda sunani, he sent it. And so the Israelis destroyed his troops. And he was under the threat of invasion also by the Egyptians. So every Jordanian venture against Israel has not, I would say, almost mutual consent, almost, at least in 67. So it's, may I attack you, please? Please keep your response down, kind of nonsense, right? And this is the kind of relationship that they're reaching with the Gulf countries as well, the Israelis. He will pretend to be enemies outside, and in private, what's that dirty Hindi saying? Din mein sister, raat mein bistar, that kind of thing. They actually have very good intel cooperation between the two, the Gulf countries, and except Qatar. The Saudis are very dependent on Israeli intel. It's one of those very interesting things which there's so many mixed signals all over the place. What you actually do. Okay. Now, there is an important message from Sushant. He's like, kya bol raha hai? Biden doesn't need to appease the Muslim vote. Where will it go to Trump? No way. If they don't vote, Trump wins hands down. Will Muslims be better off under him? That should be Biden's play. I agree. Except they might defeat him in the primaries.
ये व्हाट्सएप कर रहे हैं, काम कर रहे हैं, इसको भी बुला लेते हैं। ये क्यों व्हाट्सएप पे
हाँ,
बात कर
अरे
रहा है?
सुशांत, सुशांत अंकल, स्ट्रीम पे आओ ना, आप देख रहे हो ना, तो स्ट्रीम पे आओ.
मैं उसको भेज देता हूँ।
हाँ, सेंड हिम अ
सुशांत,
लिंक ऑन हिज ईमेल सो ही कैन जॉइन अस.
तेरे को मैं ईमेल भेज रहा हूँ, आना है आ जा। तेरे को व्हाट्सएप भी कर दिया है। सुशांत बोलेगा कि ये तो मैं फंस गया व्हाट्सएप करके, कुशल ने मुझे व्हाट्सएप। एंड यू नो व्हाट द फनी थिंग इज, ही व्हाट्सएप यू, यू डिडंट चेक इट। सो इज
बट
लाइक,
यू,
अभिजीत तो बोल व्हाट्सएप चेक कर।
हाँ, दी डेंजर इज दैट द मुस्लिम्स वोट डिफरेंटली इन द प्राइमरीज, in which case it's a huge embarrassment to Biden. He'll be the first sitting president to lose his own party primaries. Okay. And remember, these people actually come out and vote, boss. Just like in India. Hindus may vote or not vote, but Muslims will always come out and vote when they're told to vote. Okay. So this is his fear. Maybe after winning the primaries, it'll be fine. If somebody decides to challenge him, it will become a huge danger zone.
अच्छा,
So,
आई हैव अ काउंटर टू यू। मैं तेरे को एक काउंटर देना चाहता हूँ कि तूने ये इलहान ओमर और जो रशीदा तलीब का जो बात बोली है ना, देख, डेमोक्रेटिक पार्टी इज अ लार्ज बास्केट ऑफ पीपल।
यस,
अभी जॉन फेटरमैन जैसे लोग भी तो है ना, ही इज ऑल्सो अ डेमोक्रेट, राइट? सो
हेलो.
फॉर एग्जाम्पल, सो नहीं, जॉन फेटरमैन ऑल्सो हैड कम ऑन CNN, एंड आई रिमेम्बर फेटरमैन ये बोला था, आई डोंट नो इफ यू सॉ दिस, डिड यू
Joining
वॉच
us
दिस?
now to discuss Democratic Senator John Fetterman from the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Senator, what is your reaction to Iran's attack on Israel, and how worried are you that this is the beginning of an open war between the two countries?
Well, a couple of things, actually. I think it really demonstrates how it's astonishing that we are not standing firmly with Israel, and there should never be any kinds of conditions on all that. When a nation can launch hundreds of drones towards Israel, and I'm not going to be talking about conditions ever. And second, I think that also was Iran had to have some fireworks after Israel smoked that Iranian general. And I'm here for that. And I think it's just a matter of theater, part of it as well, too. And it demonstrates how unstable things are and why we need to lean in and stand with Israel.
How do you think Israel should respond? Should Israel strike within Iranian territory, or are you concerned that that might only escalate matters further?
Well, I'm not going to suggest that what Israel should or shouldn't do on that. But I also do think that Iran is pleased with, they have enough of money on the table with all of its proxies all around in the region as well, too. And Iran certainly can't take on Israel, and certainly not us. So I think they would just like to keep things as they go. And then after they made a point back, I think they could go pretty quiet and go back to just using their proxies.
A senior administration official tells CNN that President Biden told Prime Minister Netanyahu that the U.S. will not participate in any offensive operations against Iran. Do you think that's the right call, or should direct U.S. military action, as some of your colleagues in the Senate are suggesting,
Should that be on the table?
I don't agree with that, you know, and I'm just think we should follow and have Israel's back in the situation. I don't agree with the president. That doesn't change anything that he's a fantastic president, and I'm proud to stand with him and campaign for him and vote for him.
Marco Rubio was just on the show, and he said the White House leaking.
This is what you had shared, Marco Rubio.
Netanyahu not to directly respond, to take the win, quote unquote, was offensive to him because it seemed to suggest that it's Biden trying to appease the far left in his party. What's your response?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the president is entitled to his own views and whatever he decides to do. But I would never capitulate to the fringe. I'll never pander to that as well. In fact, that helps, that empowers Hamas. And Hamas they're actually convinced that they are winning the PR war. And they're never going to negotiate at this point. They think that they're going to hold on to the very end. And I know why they're not willing to provide any kind of proof of life. And I don't know why there's not more of that conversation in the media. Like, what about the hostages? What's happened to them? Where are they now? And let's just bring them home. And then all of the harsh words should be directed at Hamas, which started this and now continues to hold all of over 100 Israeli hostages.
Joining us now to...
So now here's the thing. This guy is a Democrat, but he's from Pennsylvania, which is a hardcore swing state. So I know, yes, before you say that, I acknowledge that. So, you know, his political rhetoric is going to be way more toned down compared to others. But the point is, he's also a Democrat, right, Abhijit?
See, the Democrat is a big tent of lots of competing interests. We need to remember this. You know, there's a reason, for example, all the Indian American governors have been Republican and not Democrat. Because Hispanics also vote Democrat. Blacks also vote Democrat. Muslims also vote Democrat. Jews also vote Democrat. And they're all competing. As minority interests go, the Hispanics compete with Blacks who compete with Indians, okay, for political power. Yeah. Indians have found it much easier, therefore, to rise in the Republican Party, which does not get too many Black votes in that sense, except the religious Blacks. Yeah. But they're not a very powerful vote bank out there. But they do face opposition from Republican Hispanics. So, for example, Ron DeSantis and people like that are essentially Hispanics. And there is that kind of a clash out there. But this is common. There's nothing new out here. The thing is, how do the Democrats deal with all those clashes in between? Ultimately, it's a judgment call on what they do. Do they value fundraising and money more? Or do they value votes more? Biden might just take a calculus that, you know, just open the border, let all the Hispanics in, and I'll win the election, and Muslim vote bhaadne jai. Of course, the Muslims will end up voting for him in the election, not necessarily in the primary. Therein lies the problem.
Fair enough. Okay. Now, I want to ask a few questions before we get into your Israel trip, because all the questions are about the current conflict, which is why I want to take the questions of this segment first, then I'll take the Israel trip discussion. So I'm going to start with a fan more question. So Pavak Patel has asked, according to our research, FDD Iran can now make WGU for 7 nuclear weapons in 1 month. Will this escalation force Iran to start enriching?
Can you bring up the question on screen? It's easier when I look at the question.
Okay, I'll type it and put it in the private chat, because I can't bring it up. This is on Fanmo. So, hamari private chat mein maine question dala hai. So, basically what they're saying is, will this escalation force Iran to start enriching and bypass IAEA sanction?
Sanctions won't work. See, the sanctions were only a delaying thing. The enrichment has happened long back. The question is really, do they have a valid design for bringing everything together? Okay, it's the design phase that was stopped by the this thing. And the moment America withdrew from that deal, Iran had no reason to stay in compliance with the deal either. So they would have gone very, very far ahead. There's been, what, eight years since the deal was cancelled now? 8 years, you can enrich a heck of a lot of uranium, boss, and make plutonium. So this is not something that is going to stop Iran. If Iran's decide to do something, it's going to do it.
It's
possibly already done it.
Yeah, would Iran going nuclear be worse than Pakistan going nuclear? That's such a tough question to answer. Like, how? Is it like, matlab, ek taraf khai, ek taraf kuan, this kind of a scenario?
Worse for who? Pakistan going nuclear wasn't worse for anybody except us.
Us, yeah.
Right. And maybe Afghanistan, I guess. But Iran going nuclear makes it a lot worse for the Gulf states. Especially the ones with problematic Shia minorities, because then the quantum of Shia attacks, terror attacks, will go up exponentially with a nuclear shield. Okay, there's a huge Shia majority in the oil producing provinces of Saudi Arabia. In fact, all the oil in Saudi Arabia sits exactly where the Shia majority sits.
Okay,
Bahrain is a Shia majority state ruled by a Wahhabi monarchy. Okay, you will have problems out there. Iraq is already a Shia majority state. They could just walk in and execute a sort of from soft control, it becomes hard control. Okay.
Okay.
Lebanon gets a lot more powerful because of an extended Iranian nuclear shield, should they wish to extend it out there. Okay. It also depends on what kind of thresholds they bring in. So, for example, the Pakistanis, they set out four thresholds of when they will go nuclear. An economic threshold if India destroyed too much of their economy. A military threshold if we destroy too much of their military. A territorial threshold if we capture too much of their territory. And I forget what the last one was. But in this case, Iran could say, you know, that any Israeli military incursion will invoke Iranian use of tactical nukes. What do you do then? See, so it things become, or they will send in troops to help the next uprising in Saudi Arabia or Bahrain and say that if you hit the Iranian mainland, we will go nuclear. They might come up with the first strike doctrine. Right? So what do you do? So it actually becomes a lot worse for a lot more people than Pakistan going nuclear. Pakistan going nuclear was the worst thing for us. Iran going nuclear is not really bad for us, but directly. It's bad for us indirectly because the amount of instability to our oil supplies then becomes intense.
Yes. It's actually bad for us, not good for us. Yeah. And talking about, because this question is exactly, India managed to benefit by selling refined petroleum products by Russia conflict. Will they manage to benefit this time? I actually have a very bad feeling, which is why I think, I'm sure Teko bhi bola gaya hoga multiple times that, and I mean, I just go by what reports say, that India never likes Iran being in a dicey situation is because we still have many strategic interests there.
It's not that we have strategic interests out there. It's just that we're too dependent on oil and we don't like, because see, let me show you this on Google Maps, okay? Because it helps understand the situation a lot better. Okay, let me share. Present share screen. Okay, now you see this is India here. Can you see?
Yeah.
And let's go here. Okay. Now, see, the problem is all the oil production is here. The Kuwaiti oil fields. Here, this is the 90% of, well, 100% of Saudi Arabia's production is here. Okay. Now, all of this natural gas and oil from Qatar and Bahrain and the Emirates all has to transition through the Straits of Hormuz. Every single bit of it. So literally, things blowing up there means, let's see, Iranian oil, Iraqi oil, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Seven sources of oil go offline or precarious for you. Seven separate sources of oil go precarious for you. That's never a good thing. The rise in prices would be enormous.
Yeah. So it would actually, from what I've understood, that's why I've never seen India being, you know, in this situation where India would actually benefit in any way. In this entire scenario, should USA remove sanctions from Iran to make peace and accept a nuclear Iran? In considering this scenario is anyways inevitable.
It's not necessarily inevitable. Not necessarily. You know, the problem is if you make peace with nuclear Iran, then everybody gets the message that they could go nuclear and get normalized. You're incentivizing everybody else on the block to go nuclear.
But isn't that obvious when the first state got nuclear?
But it's been controlled remarkably well. It's been controlled remarkably well. You tell me one other weapon system in history that has ever been controlled this well as nuclear weapons have been. So, and America didn't help itself. You see, Americans have also screwed up. Because the real push for Iran going nuclear was triggered by Libya. Libya gave up its nuclear program in return for guarantees of regime protection. And what did the Americans do? They abused the Americans, the French, and the Brits. They abused the UN ceasefire resolution to enact regime change in Libya, which essentially, you know, told that is really what pushed Iran. Iran started accelerating its nuclear program. Exactly when that happened, right? So you do this with these guys, it gets a lot worse.
Okay, so, let me put the next question up here. What's Iran's long-term plan here? Do they even have one, or are they going to play battleship until either side wins? Won't it stabilize Iran even more?
So, you know, a lot of people keep telling you, oh, you know, Iranian diplomats are so sophisticated. Iranian foreign policy is so sophisticated. Bullshit. Okay. Iranian diplomats are very well trained and they're constantly fighting a rear guard battle. And I'll tell you why. See, Iran at one point of time was Israel plus Saudi Arabia combined. Iran was seen as the peacekeeper of the Middle East. All of America's most choice weapons used to go to Iran. Iran had great freedom of action to do what it wanted. Nobody dared attack Iran. Okay. And then what happens is Khamenei comes to power and overnight Iran gets isolated. The industrial revolution that was happening in Iran. Iran in 1979 had a higher per capita income than South Korea and Taiwan. Iran could have become the next Germany. You know, this is why when people say we can give help to Iran, I'm like, boss, have you actually been to Iran? Their roads and construction are way ahead of us. We will go build roads out there. Bas delusion ki bhi aad hoti hai. So, this is a society whose industrialization was aborted very cruelly midway. Okay. They have, from being friends with everyone, they went overnight to being enemies with everyone. They became enemies with the Soviet Union because of Afghanistan. Look at this.
Yeah, what is this new feature in StreamYard?
Yes. It's not StreamYard. Apparently, it's Apple.
Oh. Okay, focus on the podcast.
No. I want to try this.
Because oh my God, Abhijit.
For example. it puts out this.
It doesn't do this.
I don't know. You can see.
Okay, Abhijit, focus. Focus.
I don't know. It doesn't work.
That was for Shushan Sharin.
But you saw the this thing, right? I mean, it came up and now it's gone.
Okay, Abhijit, so get why. Over. It's just a thumbs up. You know, this is a serious discussion. There are people fighting and you are worried about mere screen pe thumbs up nahi aa raha hai.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. But anyway, so what was I saying? Yeah. So what ends up happening is Iran keeps regressing back and back and back. They had no reason to alienate Israel, and they did. They had no reason to alienate America, and they went ahead. You know, America was trying so desperately to build ties with them till they went and took all the hostages in the American embassy. Okay. These people are the government out there. So it's not the people, it's the government out there are pathological. See, we think as normal states do, where, you know, even the Congress in its, even Rahul Gandhi, if it comes to too much pain to his people, he would rather surrender, sign a surrender document and go into foreign captivity than allow some great tragedy to befall this country. Not Iran. The Iranian leadership will use its people for anything and everything under the sun to preserve itself. We think that all leaders think alike. They do not. Everything is power play for them. They alienated everyone. They had good relations with everyone. What happened? I mean, they've got nobody but themselves to blame for it. And again, today, it is going worse and worse and worse. Why? You could have minded your own business. No, no, no. We want to help the Gazans. We're going to attack Israel more and more and more. Israel ne tumhara kya bigada, boss? Israel doesn't even have a border with you.
Jew hatred.
So if you want to have... Well, it's not so much Jew hatred, surprisingly. You know, there's a lot of Jew hatred around in Iran. It's actually, delusions. Because they want an Islamic revolution. It's not a Shia revolution, it's an Islamic revolution, because they want to topple all the Arab states. People don't realize this, but the Gulf monarchies, let me do Google Maps again and show you this. Present.
That, I mean, this is some high level delusion if the Iranis think they're going to do that.
Yes, it is. And let me show you this. So what happens is, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, the great Russian-supported superpower was Egypt, and the great American-supported superpower was Iran. Saudi Arabia and co. were all backwaters. Okay. And what ended up happening was, Egypt had a secular Republican government that was determined to overthrow all these monarchies out here. Because at that time, all of these were monarchies. Most of them still are. Okay. And they succeeded. Remember, Iraq became a secular Ba'athist state after the king, who was a cousin of the Jordanian king, was killed. He and his family were shot dead through a lot of these Republican, Arab Republican machinations. And these countries hated it, and they were in a perpetual cold war with Egypt. In fact, Yemen was where these countries and Egypt actually fought a cold war, and Yemen became Egypt's Vietnam. Okay, now what has happened is, Egypt, after the 1973 war and Anwar Sadat, calmed down. So they actually became, from being a revanchist power, they became status quo, and they've had good ties with everyone out here. But 1979, this becomes a theocratic republic, Iran. Okay? And they are trying to do the same thing, except all of these guys discovered that, you know, we have another tool. With Egypt, it was all Arab Brotherhood, and we are all Sunnis and things like that. So, you know, even the Cold War in Yemen had to be very covertly fought. Whereas Iran, because it is Shia, the Cold War can be very overtly fought, and it is termed as a Sunni thing, Sunni Shia thing. Okay. And in order to overcome the Sunni Shia divide, Iran has to keep supporting all Muslims everywhere, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan when required, ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Iraq when required, not in Syria. In Syria, they support the government against that. In Iraq, they supported Al-Qaeda against the Americans, but the moment the Americans withdrew and it became a Shia government, they started supporting the Shia government against these guys. And it dovetailed perfectly into the Syrian civil war as well. So here, whatever. And here they support Hamas against Israel. And it's all for Muslim leadership. Okay. So it's actually a very, what you see is the sectarianism of it. The rhetoric is the sectarian rhetoric. It's actually a very delusional, almost a cocaine addict's grand strategic game that has brought absolutely no benefits to the average Iranian. But it keeps Iran in a perpetual state of siege. So it doesn't matter how bad Iran gets. The people can never rise against the government because they'll always be portrayed as traitors.
Fair enough. Do you think this could lead to a wider conflict around the Middle East? This current conflict between Israel and...
Possibly. It depends. See, the Israelis are very good at how they calibrate. Okay, they're very, very good at calibration. They will not take an action till they've discussed through second and third order consequences and prepared for all kinds of escalation. They will not be caught with their pants down like we were after Balakot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What if Israel hits Iran's shipping? Would China stop supporting them?
China's anyway not supporting them.
Okay. Then the next...
China's supporting Iran, really. And China has actually taken a very hostile stance to Israel in Gaza. So the Israelis right now are in a situation where they don't care about China, and they're in fact intensifying military ties with Taiwan. I'm not going to tell you who, but a whole bunch of MPs that we've met are actually right now in Taiwan.
What are your thoughts on Russia near Golan Heights? Will Russia get in the conflict?
No. They have a very clear deconfliction agreement that has held for the last 10 odd years, 10, 12 years. So no, they won't.
Okay. This is, I think, about your tunnel canal thingy. Why can't the ME create a canal via UAE to bypass Hormuz? I'm sure they must have done the research.
Do you know what the... Okay, hang on. No, we really need to show people this about the cost of this, okay? Share screen. Let me first get this thing up. Because people think that tunnel building is insanely, not tunnels, canals. Canal building is insanely expensive. Let me show you how big the Suez Canal is first. Now, there was always the greater... the Great Bitter Lake and the Small Bitter Lake out here. And there were already 2-3 lakes. But anyway, this is how big the Suez Canal is. And if you measure it in today's terms, is there a measuring tool? Measure distance from here to here. It's 147 kilometers. Okay. The Panama Canal is even smaller, and this is insanely expensive. Now, in order to... Let me show you all the problems. In order to bypass this, you need to build a tunnel from, say, here, say, Port of Abu Dhabi to Sohar, which would be measure distance... Okay, so let's see from here to Sohar, 224 kilometers. Okay, double the length. It'll cost you some insane $100-150 billion to do it in this day and age. Mm. Plus, what ends up happening is here, you see, nobody is attacking this. Here, you've literally created a narrow road. A 2-3 lane highway with thousands of ships passing. All the Iranians have to do is sink a ship here and sink a ship here, and you've trapped thousands of ships in here. which you can then slowly pick off one after the other after the other. It is militarily, it is suicidal. Militarily suicidal. And the economics don't pan out except in war. Because remember what you're bypassing out here. This made sense because you, without that, you had to sail all the way like this. Okay. The Panama Canal here made sense because otherwise you had to sail all the way like this. Here, you want to create a canal which is double the size of the Suez Canal just to do this, which is actually a very broad passage. It makes no economic sense whatsoever.
Chalo, doomsday question. Does four countries in a continuous geography, China, India, Pakistan, Iran, being nuclear, spell a doomsday for our region in the future and change our geopolitics? What are the Chinese and Russian apprehensions about Irani nukes, if any?
Well, it makes things a lot more complicated for sure. Look, we've lived with a lot of nuclear neighbors, okay? We already have, what, four nuclear neighbors. People don't count America in the south, but America has bases in Chagos Archipelago,
yeah,
which is just a few kilometers, 1,000 kilometers south of Kanyakumari, okay? And it's one of their most potent aero-naval bases. There are both air-launch nukes kept out there and naval nukes kept out there. It's a submarine base as well. We'll deal with it. Now, Chinese and Russian apprehensions of Iranian nukes. Chinese have no apprehensions. The Chinese love giving nuclear weapons to everyone. They were the facilitators of the AQ Khan smuggling network. The Russians, on the other hand, have a very, very, historically, they've had a very circumspect history of nukes. They don't like other countries getting nukes. They weren't too happy about India getting nukes either. You know, contrary to popular belief, they did not help us with our nuclear weapons. Once we got nukes and it became fait accompli, they then started helping us with our nuclear submarine, but they did not help us. Not one iota did they help us with our nuclear weapons. Okay, so there are two very different things. And Russia, the last thing it wants is another unstable nuclear country on its south, a very high risk accepting nuclear country in its south. Because remember, today what applies to Hamas in against Israel, tomorrow will apply to Chechens and Dagestanis in the Caucasus against Russia. They don't want that. It's very easy to weaponize Russia. Russia has a huge Muslim minority. The Tatars are very peaceful, but the Dagestanis and the Chechens are not. You can use that against them, you see. So the Russians are... don't like it at all.
Yeah, so now I want to talk about your trip to Israel, but before that, agar World War 3 hone wali hai to kam se kam meri book padh ke marna sabke sab. So jao abhi, go to Amazon and place a pre-order for my book, because if you are going to die, might as well die and learn something and die. So World War 3 ke pehle jao sab log meri book padhna, aur jo book padega, yaad rakhna ye book hai, my book's name is Nastic, Why I'm Not an Atheist. Jo ye meri book padega, uske sapne mein Abhijit aayega aur dance karega. Yaad rakhna ye sab log. Aapko agar Abhijit ke dances ko apne sapno mein dekhna hai, to jaake meri book do. Anyways, now tell me, so how was your trip to Israel? This is what I was really interested. Yes, sala Iran aur Israel ka phadda ho gaya beech mein aur mera pura satyanash ho gaya podcast ka, because I wanted to do a podcast about this. Now tell me, how was your Israel trip?
So very sad. It's the first time I've been there where they've suffered that much loss, because you know, since I was born, they've not really had this kind of this thing. But it's remarkable what a resilient society they are, because you know, life goes on as normal. You don't get a sense that there's a war going on when you're in Tel Aviv, or even we went way south to Ashdod, and we went to the kibbutzes. We went to a lot of the kibbutzes that got hit, Nahaloz and Beri and places, Sderot, which is a city, it's not a kibbutz. That got hit, and they've recovered. Mentally, they've not recovered, but they're going on with life as normal. It was really scary. You know, images don't capture 90% of what we saw. We got shown certain videos and things like that, which they refused to put out. okay? Because they don't have permission from the families. They're very strict about this permission from the family business, because it's a very crucial tenet of their religion that, you know, every body part has to be collected. The body, even viewing the body by others, is viewed as a violation of the body and things like that. And it's a question of societal trust. If the government violates that trust, it's not good. And, you know, even in Berry and Nahalos, we weren't allowed to go to wherever we wanted. There were only two families, for example, in Berry that had given permission, and we could only go there. In Nahalos, we couldn't go to the military barracks because about three, four of the families, most of the families were okay, but three, four of the families whose kids got killed out there said no. So even for those three, four, even if it had been one family, we would not be allowed to go out there. And the kind of stuff we saw, I've put out all the pictures on Twitter. You know, it was very curiously, it was Palestinians, Gazans working in these things that provided the intel to Hamas, telling them where the family slept, how many people per house, whom to go hit, at what time, what work they do, etc., etc., etc. Which is why they've kicked out all the Palestinian workers and they're getting Indians instead. And we saw the first batch of Indians land out there. Well, not the first, it was the third or fourth batch.
So as far as I wanted to know, you must have gone around. So what is the mood in the nation? Like how anti Bibi Netanyahu the nation was, you felt?
Don't feel that. There may be anger, but till you prod them, they're not talking about it.
It's very interesting.
Overwhelmingly, the anger is Israelis are not like Indians who will go shit on their country abroad. Okay. There's a state of emergency like this.
Wait, Israelis are not like Indian Hindus?
Not in this sense. they will not go around. They will criticize Bibi, but they won't call him a fascist and this and that.
Yeah.
They'll call him a crook, sure. But they won't say that, you know, he's a murderer and this and that and all that nonsense. What happens out here is there is a whole load of anger at what happened on that day. The anger against what happened that day and the need to fix it is much, much greater than anything against BB. In fact, I felt very little anger towards BB. They're not happy with him, but they're not being vicious to him like they are with the Gazans at the moment.
But then I was wondering, how does one look at it? Like, what is the narrative around Palestine in Israel? Like, what do they think about Palestine?
Look, they've said this for a long time that it needs to be a two-state solution. Every single time they were given the opportunity for a two-state solution, the Palestinians squandered it. Okay? The last deal, which was between, which was meant to be between Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat, where Yasser Arafat was ultimately promised 97%. So the deal was no right of return, but you give 97% of the occupied territories slowly, in sequentially, as in when you prove that you're able to manage security. Yasser Arafat said no. And then he keeps coming back to the table and saying, well, you promised me 97% then. Now give me 99. Now give me 110%. That's not the way negotiations work, you know. And in order to force their hand, they keep grabbing more territory because they're like, we offered you 97% in 2001, 2002, I forget. It was 97. I think it was 97, 98. 97% in 97, 98. The longer this goes on and the longer you refuse terms, the less territory you're going to keep getting. They're very clear about it. It's the only way they have of forcing the Palestinian hand. And so what the Palestinians are doing is, since the 1990s when they got self-rule, they have been reproducing at insane rates. Till Israel took over Gaza and West Bank in 67, these were horrible third world places with high infant mortality and things like that. In the 20 years that followed, 67 to 87, there was a huge amount. I've tweeted out the link of the World Bank report on this. A huge amount of improvement. Infant mortality dropped dramatically. Employment grew dramatically. Education grew dramatically. The use of electricity and plumbed water grew dramatically, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what ended up happening was in the 90s, the moment they get self-rule, they decide they're going to outpopulate the Israelis and ask for their rights in a, as a majority in a united state. So it is, in fact, the Palestinians who don't want a two-state solution and the Israelis want a two-state solution. And the way the game theory works is, one, we're going to keep reducing the amount of land that you get in every successive negotiation, number one. And number two, if you think you're going to get a united territory, forget about it. You're never going to get it. So everything they do is, it is in fact, it would be calamitous to deny a two-state solution for the Israelis. Because if you look, I just Googled the population. Let me do this. Let me share this for you. Google.com. Yeah. Okay. Let me share this so you can see it live. Okay. Population of Gaza.
6 lakh. Approximately,
you know, it's actually a lot more. I don't know why it's saying.
So, someone says 7-8 lakh.
Gaza City. No. Gaza Strip. Population of Gaza Strip. It's several million. Yes. Yeah, it's 2 million. Okay. Then population of West Bank. Is 2.7 million Palestinians. Yeah. We're not talking about the Israelis. Okay. And 2.7 plus 2 million is 4.7 million. Now, demographics of Israel. You see how many Arabs are there? Are Arab, 2 million. So see, it's already 6.5 million Arabs and 7.2 million Jews. You see? So they're basically trying to outpopulate. They have insane population rates, fertility rates. In fact, Israel is the only OECD country that has a fertility rate of 3, which is well over replacement. It is the only OECD country that's growing. Because the Jews are also trying to do it, and it's mostly, and it's skewing the balance in Israel, because what's happening is the people producing the most kids are the Orthodox Jews, who don't do military service and things like that. So it's skewing the ratio of secular to Orthodox Jews out there, which is making Israel also more hardline. So 7.2 million to 6.5 million. It used to be a much more skewed ratio before. They're planning on overtaking. They don't want a two-state. The Palestinians don't want a two-state. Israel wants a two-state. And in fact, most of the Israeli hardliners are very upset with Bibi because they want a forcible separation to happen with or without Palestinian consent. So that a unified state where Palestinians demand their rights as Israeli citizens and become the majority does not happen.
Okay, one last question and then we'll wrap up. I know you have to do your media rounds today. So what do you think India could learn from this trip that you have gone there from Israel in terms of technology, whether in agriculture, whether in defense, or in cultural consciousness?
Nothing from this trip, because look, we're both very resilient societies, right? India is also extremely resilient. People don't give us... We're resilient in a very different way. Not all resilience is the same. Okay. And agriculture and technology, we didn't cover much of that. I was mostly focused on security, and that is what I covered throughout, except the trip to Jerusalem and things where, for me, it was mostly interviewing their members of parliament or members of the Knesset, as it's called, to figure out where they stood. We got to meet a lot of people out there and interview them and find out what they actually thought. Some agreed to come in camera. One agreed to come in camera. The rest didn't.
So did you? How many people from that Fauda? How many people from Fauda did you meet? You jackass.
Just one guy from Fauda, Zahi Alevi, and he's great fun. He's great fun to talk to. He's very smart. You know, he's not like your typical Indian Bollywood himbo who will be like, oh, world peace and this and that. He's married to an Arab Muslim, by the way. And he was talking a lot about how difficult it was and things like that, how the Israeli right trolls his wife, who herself is quite nationalist. And, you know, how they sort out problems when problems arise at home and so on and so forth. Because, you know, he had a very international upbringing. He spent a lot of his childhood abroad in Belgium and places like that. So he learned a lot of languages. And so it was great fun talking to him. It didn't last long. It was just an hour long interaction. I thought they were going to introduce us to Gal Gadot. But I was happy. I much prefer Zahi Alevi to Gal Gadot. Gal Gadot is pregnant, by the way. Otherwise, they wanted us to introduce us to Gal Gadot. But yeah, so that's the story so far. And you know, if you go to a terrorism-affected house in India, contrary to what you see in Bollywood, you're not going to see hysterics. Indians have a great way of dealing with loss. And you see that with the Israelis as well. They deal with it differently, but it's different, but very similar.
I can understand. And especially societies with a very long history of trauma, right? Where you've had a series of invasions, when you've had series people.
They take the loss much harder. Because see, in military service, the son of the richest man in Israel would have been serving with the son of the poorest man in Israel. So when the son of the poorest man dies, the son of the richest man takes it very, very personally. They're not a society that tolerates class differences. You know, they're very, if you try acting snooty, they'll cut you down to size in no time. Okay. There is no sahib and this and that, and there's no hierarchy in that society at all. They're very intolerant of hierarchy. They're very socialistic in their mindset that way. Right. Whereas in India, when poor people die, it's like, oh my God, it's a poor people problem. It's not really, rich people don't really die.
Until 2611 happened. Then it all changed.
Until 2611 happened, because then it was lots of rich people dying in the Taj.
Yeah. So, which is why I think 2611 in a very weird way kind of changed the psychology of India on all these issues, is because rich people died this time. I clearly remember this. So, yeah. It's just one question. Do you know what percentage of land and homes were where forceful evictions of Arabs and Muslims was opposed to purchase by Jews from origin of... Kya itna gandi English mein ek to question poochte hai na log. I mean, ye English ko main kaise read karun abhi? Is English ko main kaise read karun?
I don't know the percentages, but it was quite significant. I would say almost 40% of pre-1967 Israel it wasn't forcibly evicted. I would say about 1% were forcibly evicted, but the rest chose to leave, and the Israelis didn't do anything to prevent them from leaving. They opened the borders and said, you want to leave, leave. Let them come back in. As opposed to the rest of the Arab world, which kicked out the rest of the Muslim world, which kicked out all their Jews. And it was a near equal exchange of populations. About 700,000 Arabs were kicked out to different countries. To Egypt, to mostly to Jordan. You know, Jordan, people don't realize this, but Jordan is now 70% Palestinian. Of course, Jordan never recognized Palestine. They considered Israel to be part of them. It's only after 87 or something like that they decided that Palestine is actually a separate country and not part of Jordan. Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, all these places, there was immigration. And about 900,000 Jews were kicked out of the Arab world, from Tunisia, Morocco, Iraq, Iran, Yemen, all these places. They were all kicked out. Egypt, huge population in Egypt that was kicked out, huge population in Algeria that was kicked out. So and, all the Arab countries, so it was almost a near equal exchange of population.
And how was the relationship of Iran and Indian Shias? Like, has there been any report written on it? Like, how are the relationships there?
See, it's Indian Shias are divided into three. One is the Jafri. And the Jafris are probably the majority. And that is the Iranian 12er denomination. The second are the Ismailis and the Boris and people like that. And see, the thing is, with the Ismailis and Boris, they're so rich. They don't vote on identity things, and most of them end up voting for Modi anyway.
BJP.
Boris, for example, the leader, the Sayyidina, tells them to vote. Fatwa dete hain ki BJP ke liye vote karo. So all those Muslims you saw hugging Modi in Egypt and places like that, they're all Boris.
They're all, yeah, Boris.
Okay. The Ismailis are almost Hindu rakhlo. Like Shehzad's mother, Shehzad's entire family, and Tehsin's entire family. You say Jai Shri Ram bolo, they'll say Jai Shri Ram. In fact, they'll turn it around and say, tu Jai Shri Ram bol. That's what Shehzad does. Now he can recite the entire Hanuman Chalisa and he keeps challenging people from the Congress party, Hindus from the Congress party.
To recite that was so good. That was so good. He did right. It on live TV once.
Yeah. So, you know, they are like completely Hinduized in that. So if you look at, I want you to go look at His Royal Highness Aga Khan visits Houston, or His Royal. So all the American communities of Ismailis out there, they will literally wear bindis and do dandiya dance to welcome the Aga Khan.
Hmm.
Okay, so they're very, and that's because the leader himself is very, very cosmopolitan, right? And imagine this is the same sect that was the Hashashum, the assassins, where you get the word assassins. They were the most radical.
Hmm.
Who have become the most progressive, just like Oman. Oman was the Kharijites who were, for the longest time, considered the most extraordinary radical sect. They considered Ali, because he resigned the caliphate to Muawiyah. He was a traitor and they killed him. They killed him. And they were an extraordinary radical sect. And today you look at Oman, it's never had a terror attack in like 40, 50 years. It's completely chilled out country. It was the first, they've had a Hindu temple there for the last 40, 50 years, way before the UAE. You'll never see Omanis in any terror list or anything like that, right? So, of course, they're Kharijites and Shias, but they're Sunnis. But here, what ends up happening is the Jafris, a large population is in Kashmir. And after the Hindus got kicked out, they started to be seen as the mukhbirs, the informants of the Indian government. Because remember, by this time, by 1989, the Shia-Sunni split that we spoke about was intense. So the Sunni-Shia hatred had become intense. Remember, Jinnah was a Shia. A lot of the people that created Pakistan were Shias, but because thanks to Iran in that sense, a lot of the Jafris have become, I won't say they're pro-India, but they're definitely not like the Sunnis. Let's put it that way.
I think it's a strategic push, right? You have to hedge your bet.
As opposed to, say, the Ismailis and Boris, who are like, "Ha, hum Hindustani hai, dhol bajao," kind of nonsense.
वही है चलो एंड ऑन दैट पॉजिटिव नोट वी विल एंड टुडेस पॉडकास्ट एज ऑलवेज यू गाइस कैन गो एंड फॉलो अभिजीत ऑन एक्स ट्विटर जो बुलाना है उसको बुलाओ आई ट्राई टू टेक एज मेनी क्वेश्चंस एज पॉसिबल आई एम हैप्पी दैट अभिजीत डिड नॉट गेट टू मीट गैल गैडोट नहीं तो मेरी बहुत सड़ती थी कि अकेला मिलके आया वंडर वुमन को हमको वंडर वुमन को मिलना है देख नहीं हो रहा है देख ये वाले एक्सप्रेशन पे नहीं होता है And imagine, I took the name of Gal Gadot. You should have done that heart symbol, but you did not do it. What does it say about you? See, it says that you suck. Oh, you got the thumbs up, Abhijit. Wow, nice. You got the thumbs up. Good for you. It's not going to use that because that would be a violation of social media norms, I guess, or something. Apple will not allow that. So, guys, as always, thank you very much for tuning in. Today's podcast was a little early because now Abhijit has to go back to back on shouting, screaming matches of mainstream media. सो गो चेक हिम आउट ऑन मेन स्ट्रीम मीडिया. आज पता नहीं किधर है, किधर है तू? 8, 9, 10 बजे आज आज किधर जाने
आठ
वाला तू?
बजे 8 बजे मैं News 18 पे हूँ, फिर 9 बजे किसी और पे हूँ, और 10 बजे संजय दीक्षित जी के साथ पॉडकास्ट करना है.
वेरी गुड, चलो करो करो चलो. सो गाइस वील रैप टूडेज डिस्कशन अप. या पीपल वर आस्किंग दिल्ली में बुक का कुछ होने वाला? यस होगा. अभिजीत, मैं, आनंद, श्याम, वेर आई एम प्लानिंग. वेन्यू फाइनल करने दो, मेरे को इतने मैसेज आ गए हैं उसके लिए, मेरी बुक के लिए मैं दुखी हो गया हूँ. लेट मी फाइनलाइज द वेन्यू. आई विल अनाउंस इट ऑन सोशल मीडिया एट एन अप्रोप्रिएट टाइम. समथिंग माइट बी डन इन मुंबई ऑल्सो ऑन द 28th of April. आई विल अनाउंस ऑल ऑफ दैट. वी विल रैप टूडेज डिस्कशन. एज ऑलवेज, इफ यू वॉन्ट टू सपोर्ट द पॉडकास्ट, देर आर मल्टीपल वेज. नंबर वन, you can join the membership program on YouTube, Fanmo, Patreon, wherever you want to go. You can join the membership program there. You can buy the merchandise on Kadak Merch or on my own website, kushalmehra.com. You can also send your donations through UPI. And now that my book is out, once again, you can go pre-order my book on Amazon, Nastic, Why I'm Not an Atheist. Remember, if you buy, pre-order my book, Abhijit will come in your dreams and he will do those wonderful dances that he's known for. So, go buy my book. And if you can't do any of that, just leave a rating if you're listening to this on your audio platform, or like the video, subscribe to the channel. I'll see you guys next time. Take care. Bye-bye. Jai Shri Ram.